You're listening to Season 2, Episode 18 of 88 Cups of Tea with Yin Chang.
Am I doing this right? Hi, I'm your host, Yin Chang, and thanks for joining me on 88 Cups of Tea. This podcast is created to leave you feeling motivated from interviews with storytellers, where we learn how they create opportunities for a successful career without losing sight of the values that make us human. Whew, that was a really long run-on sentence.
Hey, Storyteller Tribe! Before we get into today's interview, I wanted to thank Gotham Writers for sponsoring today's episode. They teach creative writing classes in New York City and online and have built an incredible writing community. Be sure to hang around at the end of the show to find out why Gotham has earned an amazing reputation within the writers community. I'm so excited to share today's episode with you. We have award-winning author Louise O'Neill on the show with us. The Guardian named her the best young adult fiction writer alive today. Louise's first novel, called Only Ever Yours, was a multiple award winner and sold its movie rights. Her second novel, called Asking For It, was a number one bestseller in her native Ireland and was named the overall book of the year at the 2015 Irish Book Awards. A fun fact, I got a hold of Louise for the interview while she's in Ireland. In our conversation, we discussed rape culture and how her book Asking For It is igniting a much-needed conversation to create real change. We also uncover what the heavy research process was like for Louise's second novel, why it's crucial for writers to write their story the way it's demanding to be told, and how to authentically portray characters and the world they live in. Get ready for a thoughtful and stimulating episode that will awaken you. Now let's jump right in. Hey everyone! Oh my gosh, we have Louise O'Neill with us today on the show. Louise, how are you? Thank you so much for being here with us. What's up?
Not much. I always forget before I talk to Americans, because I used to live in New York, but I always forget how enthusiastic you are. It's so amazing because Irish people are a little bit more downbeat.
That's amazing. Where in New York were you living?
I was living in Brooklyn. I was working in Manhattan though, but Brooklyn was really creative and fun and I loved it.
I'm not cool enough for Brooklyn. Slightly jealous. But Louise, thank you so much again for being on the show. Why don't we kick it off? And let me start by asking you, how did you fall in love with writing?
Oh, goodness. That's a hard question. But I suppose, you know, growing up in my house, my mother used to be an English teacher before she gave up to when she had myself and my sister. So I grew up in a house where reading was just encouraged. And we were, you know, she bought us loads of books and she brought us to the library every week. And I think there was just a real love of literature and stories and storytelling in my house. And I suppose because of that, I had a really vivid imagination. So I loved writing. But it wasn't really until I was in my 20s that I started to think that maybe writing would be something that I would like to do as a career. Before that, I wanted to be an actress. And I suppose in some ways they're not that different, because it's really just about portraying a character, inhabiting a character, understanding their motivation and telling their story.
Absolutely. And it's like exposing a part of yourself too.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow, that's so cool that you were thinking about being an actor, because I did acting for 8 years and I'm trying to work on writing. So I'm like, oh, I totally feel you. That's amazing. Did you go to school for acting?
No, my parents wanted me to go to school for acting when I was 18. But I think I'd sort of suffered with an eating disorder throughout my teenage years. And I think I was very nervous at the thought of, I suppose, putting myself forward for the kind of rejection and the emphasis on physical and physicality and, you know, appearance that seemed to go along with acting. So I decided to study English at college or at university instead. But I think you'll find it actually that it's very useful when it comes to writing, because, you know, as I said, it's the same sort of thing with acting, that you really have to understand a character's motivation and sort of inhabit them in a way. And I think that's actually very useful. And also because I had seen a lot of theatre and had been involved in theatre, even just that sort of sense of pacing that's really important throughout a play, and the rhythms of language and dialogue, that'll all, I think, really help you when it comes to writing.
Thank you for that. I will keep that in my heart and I will remember that when I'm working on it. And by the way, you're so lucky that your parents were so encouraging with acting and wanted you to go. Because I'm like, that's so opposite with me. My parents are like, hell no, you're going to be a doctor, or you're going to be a pharmacist or a businesswoman. And that's it.
Yeah, I think, to be honest, they're quite unusual because most parents, I think, want their children to have very stable careers. Mm-hmm. And they're not artistic or creative in any way, but I think they just saw something in me, some sort of ability, which was particularly, I suppose, artistic or creative in nature. And they wanted to encourage that within me. And it was really me resisting that, resisting, I suppose, my own power. Sounds really strange, but that kind of idea of sometimes I think we can be very afraid of trying to really take advantage of our own abilities for fear of failure, I think. And sometimes it's easier to fail at something that you don't really want rather than to fail at something that you want with all of your heart.
I'm getting some chills right now.
I'm very deep.
Very deep, girl. That was real quick. 2 minutes in when we knee deep. No, that very much resonates, I think, with a lot of listeners. And also, at times, myself, too. You know, we're all, I think a lot of us do fear losing at what we really, really, really want. You know, just I think that just hurts so much more than being able to say, well, I half-assed the other one, but it's okay because I didn't care about the other thing.
Absolutely. And I think as well with writing, before I wrote my own book, I used to get so jealous when I heard about other people who were writing or who had book deals. And it was so easy in a way because in my head, I could say, well, if I wrote a book, it would be better than their book. And if I wrote a book, my book would be the best book that's ever been written. And actually, I had to leave go of that because, you know, I think that I probably get about 85% of the way there. And I have to just say, you know what, that's good enough. And I tried my best. And that has to be good enough because in my head, it's perfect. And nothing is perfect in real life. It is just about trying to, I suppose, accept that. And some days I struggle with that more than others, you know?
Yeah, I do. I totally agree with that. And also, I see writing as an art form. And my grandpa's an artist. And he always taught me that there's never perfection. Art is always work. Yeah. There's always improvements to be made. So never, ever, ever expect perfection because that will eat you alive.
Yeah, absolutely. And I remember reading a quote and it was, perfectionism is the enemy of creativity. And I think that's so true because creativity is about making mistakes. And it is about, I suppose, fucking up sometimes and, you know, just thinking that you just do your best and you just try. And I think it's trying sometimes that this sort of obsession with perfection actually paralyzes us.
Yes, absolutely agree. Now, backtrack just a few steps. I know you mentioned that there is some time in your early 20s that you realized writing this could be my thing. Do you remember that moment? What was it like, something a professor said to you in college?
No, I mean, there's, you know, I think there was many different moments that I could sort of maybe pinpoint. Sometimes I think when I read other books or if I, not even so much, if I saw, I remember just certain things that if I saw other people achieve, if let's say my dad wanted to run a marathon and, you know, I saw him put the work and the training into it. And then I saw his sort of elation when he finished the marathon and he had, you know, done it in a good time. And there was something about that that I looked at and I was like, this is what I want. I want to put my mind to something, try my very best and know that I can do it. And that moment of achieving it. So I think there were certain things like that, and there was books maybe that I read that I remember putting down and thinking, God, I really wish I could have this sort of impact on someone else the way that this book has impacted upon me. Particularly, funnily enough, actually, when I was in my early 20s, I was very late coming to Harry Potter. A friend made me read it, and there was just something about it that I remember finishing the last book and... And I don't read fantasy, so, it was quite an unusual sort of a choice for me. But I remember putting down the last book and crying and just feeling like as if I knew these characters and I knew that they were real people and feeling so devastated by the fact that the series had ended. And then just thinking, my God, what power? Again, I don't mean power in a bad way, but just what a moment of for her of channeling something so incredible that it touched so many people in ways that she'll never even begin to understand. And I remember thinking, God, I would love to do that. I would, even in, like, obviously not quite to the same extent, because if you're going to start your writing career hoping you're going to be the next J.K. Rowling, then you might be a little bit disappointed. But I thought, you know, it would just be nice to even a very small fraction of that, just to feel like that I had created something that might, I suppose, touch another person.
Okay, on that topic, You very much did and continue to touch a lot of people. And for listeners, Luis wrote two incredible books. And the first one is Only Ever Yours. The second one, Asking for It. And they're topics that not a lot of writers dare to touch. If you don't mind, can we talk a bit about Asking for It?
Of course.
Okay, so this book has definitely touched and shaken a lot of readers, if not all. What was your inspiration behind writing Asking for It?
Actually, I suppose, funnily enough, the main inspirations actually came from America. I was finishing up my first novel, Only Ever Yours, in 2012 when Todd Akin was running for senator. And he was asked in an interview if he ever thought that abortion was acceptable. And he said no. And the interviewer asked him, well, what if the woman has been raped? And Todd Akin said, well, you know, if it's a legitimate rape, then the body has ways of shutting it down so that the woman doesn't get pregnant.
So stupid.
Todd is clearly an expert in the female body. I was so struck by that. And I think that idea of legitimate rape, or some rapes being more authentic or legitimate than others, really stuck with me. And then after that, there was the Steubenville case and the Maryville case, both happened in the US. And I think I was so enthralled in a really odd way by both of those cases because they were so horrifying, but I couldn't stop reading the coverage about them. And I think actually the reason why I was so obsessed, really, I suppose is the only right word to use, is because I could really see similarities between the communities involved and the small town that I lived in and grew up in Ireland. And I kept thinking, well, what if that had been me? What if that had been me at a party? And it just felt very, very close to the bone and too possible. It just felt too possible. And I suppose I decided that I was going to take inspiration, particularly from the Steubenville case, and translate it into an Irish context. And it did so with frightening ease, because rape culture isn't just specific to the United States, or it's not just specific to small towns in Ireland. You know, this is a global issue.
I have two younger sisters and they're both in college right now. So obviously, of course, talking about Maryville case and the Steubenville case, especially Steubenville was the one where they were posting on social media, right?
Yeah.
And that really pissed me off. And I just couldn't help but think, like, what the hell is wrong with these people nowadays? Mm. Where they would put that up. This is a gang of people, you know, doing this to one person. Doesn't matter if it's one-to-one or a gang of people. The point is it's being done. It shouldn't be done in the first place. And you know what angers me is, to be very honest, my middle sister, she's in college right now, and she is very social. She's like the head of all the activities and leads a lot of groups. She loves to go out and she loves to host a lot of parties. I'm a very protective sister. I'm like 10, 11 years older than them. So I'm like mama bear. And you know what angers me is that I am upset at myself for even wanting to say to my sister, don't wear such a short dress.
I know.
But then in the first place, why would I even have to say that? The way it should be is that guys shouldn't even think, or people overall, women too. Like, I mean, I'm guilty of it, where I wanted to tell my sister because I can't control the guys, because I don't know who these guys are going to be. But to me, I felt like the only thing that I can control, or at least try, all I can say is don't make advances where it makes the guys think you're welcoming things, and be careful of what you wear. But it makes me mad that I want to say that. Do you know what I'm saying?
No, I agree. There's a real difficulty when it comes actually to women wearing what we would deem, I suppose, as provocative clothing, because first of all, there's so much pressure on women to act and behave and to dress in a very sexualized manner, you know. We're bombarded constantly with images of hyper-sexualized women. And we're sort of told that this is what we have to do in order to attract a man, and that to attract a man is sort of our main purpose in life.
Mm-hmm.
And then we are shamed if we do try and conform to that and wear the clothing. So it's kind of impossible.
Yeah.
It's like, well, you know, you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't.
Yep.
And I'm very loath, I suppose, to tell a woman what she can and can't wear, because the thing is, I used to work in fashion and I absolutely adore clothes. And when I get up in the morning and I get dressed, I never pick out something thinking, oh, you know, this is really sexy. And I was going through an airport recently and I had bought what I thought was a very cool kind of latex skirt, and I was wearing it and I really genuinely had bought this skirt thinking that's so cool. And then this bachelor party was walking towards me,
oh God,
and they, you know, started kind of yelling and screaming at me, and I felt so incredibly intimidated. And then as they passed, the first thought that was in my head was, I shouldn't have worn this skirt. And then I just thought, I didn't wear this skirt to attract attention. I didn't wear it, you know, thinking that I would be screamed at and, you know, physically intimidated in an airport by a group of drunken men. But I thought it was so interesting that my first instinct was to think, what did I do wrong? What could I have done differently? Why did I attract this sort of attention? And I think that is the problem with women, is that we have been conditioned actually to blame ourselves.
First of all, I'm really sorry that happened to you. Like, that is uncalled for and should never happen to anybody. So I'm so sorry that happened to you.
And I know, you're fine.
I feel like that's a conversation that you have sparked through your book, Asking for It. And I'm very grateful for that. That's the conversation that people need to have. Like you said, it's a global issue. It doesn't matter where you are. Even in New York, I've been put in situations where I felt a very similar type of fear. So going to college in New York City, I would wear sweatpants, a cap, tie up my hair, put a hoodie over it, and no joke, like a sweater over it. And it's to a point where I've conditioned myself where I feel like if I were to enjoy clothing and style, I would be asking for trouble. It's like the root of it.
But the thing is, I mean, it's so ridiculous because women in burkas, you know, get catcalled. And, you know, women get raped in like sweatpants or their pajamas.
Yes.
It's really actually got nothing to do with clothes. It's really got nothing to do with perceived sexiness. All of this kind of sexual violence and sexual intimidation and street harassment has nothing to do with sex, actually. It's all about power, dominance, trying to intimidate people, trying to frighten people. And I suppose it's just another way of trying to control women by saying, actually, you know what, it's your clothing and it's your behavior and it's the way you appear that's causing this. And that's actually probably got so little to do with it.
You know what? I want to know, how was your research process for Asking for It? I'm sure you were emotionally drained like nobody's business. How was the research process like for you?
I mean, it was pretty tough. I visited the Rape Crisis Center sort of in my home city, and I spoke to victims and or survivors, however they wanted to be sort of termed. I also spoke to barristers and lawyers and spoke to people in the sexual assault treatment unit, read first person narratives and memoirs, just really, I think, doing everything that I could to try and make sure that I would not only, I suppose, convey Emma, the main character, as authentic a manner as I possibly could, but also to make sure that I didn't make any mistakes when it came to, you know, the legal system in Ireland and the judicial system, and just to make sure that that was right as well.
How long approximately did that take you?
You know what, the thing is, it's funny because I think I did it kind of simultaneously, because, you know, the way the book is divided into two parts. So the first part of the book, I really didn't need to do any research for, because it's just about a teenager living in a small town, and I know what that's like. So while I was writing the first part of the book, I was simultaneously doing all the research. So then by the time we got to the second part of the book, I sort of had all of that done. So I think the first draft took about 6 months, but then the editing then takes about a year after that, you know, so that's sort of the real extensive work when you're getting in deep.
I'm even thinking the 6 months is really fast. Holy moly.
Yeah, the thing is, I probably won't be able to do that with this. I'm working on my third book at the moment, but I did that with both Only Ever Yours and Asking for It, but it's a very intense 6 months, working 7 days a week, very long hours, not really going out or seeing people, really kind of locking myself away in my bedroom for that period of time. And it was very intense, and actually particularly with Asking for It, because of the nature of the book and because it was quite, I suppose, a disturbing story, it really took a toll on me emotionally. And I was really exhausted and really drained, and just felt like I had sort of cut my veins open and bled all over the page a bit, you know. And I think I needed some time to just recover after it.
Yeah, that was actually what I was wondering. How were you after, compared to when you first started the book? What was that like for you? Were you just feeling like you're trying to get out for like a breath of air?
You know what? It did change me. It changed me because I suppose there were things that I couldn't unsee or that I can't unknow now. Obviously, I've had, you know, quite a few personal struggles. I suffered with an eating disorder, and it's not like that I had this sort of life where everything was perfect and that nothing unfortunate ever happened to me. But I suppose I was always a really positive person, and I always looked at the world in a very optimistic, almost Pollyanna-ish way. And there was something about this book and the research for it that it really made me look at the world in a different way. I suppose made me more aware of the darkness that a human being can hold, or the sadness. And I think that kind of broke me a small bit. Also, maybe just the injustice surrounding women and men who are the victims of sexual violence, and also the prevalence of it. I don't think you could write a book like this and do that sort of research and not be affected by it and not be changed by it.
Do you think after this research and understanding more about it, and like you said, after writing a whole book about it, how do you think we as readers and as people around the world, what can we do?
I think there's some very concrete things that people can do. I think the first one is that when someone tells you their story of sexual assault or unwanted touching or rape, any sort of sexual violence, I think the most important thing is to believe them, because that's what they want, actually. And, you know, having spoken to survivors of rape and sexual violence, they say that sometimes the actual attack itself is traumatizing enough, but it's the reaction of other people afterwards that sort of re-traumatizes them over again. Mm-hmm. So I think the most important thing is to believe people when they tell you that this has happened to them, to support them and to believe them. Because, you know, we've this sort of myth of false rape claims, you know, while they do occur, it's very low. It's sort of 1-2%. So, you know, 98 times of 100 out of 100 times when someone tells you that they have been raped, they're telling the truth. I think that there should be a demand for real change made to the laws to ensure that, I suppose, that rape and sexual violence is taken seriously, that it's given appropriate, you know, people who are convicted are given appropriate jail time. And also, I suppose, to try and ensure that the conviction rates are increased, because really they are dismally low in most countries. And I suppose the last thing that I think is very important is around the issue of consent. While the idea of consent workshops for freshmen at university are, you know, I think that's a fantastic idea, it is a little bit too late. I think mandatory sex education programs need to be present in every school, regardless of religious orientation, and that consent form an integral and essential part of those sex education programs.
I really appreciate that you really put a lot of thought to it and brainstormed on actual actionable ways that we can go about it. There's companies that do campaigns and commercials and whatnot, but yes, you see it, you're affected, but then what? Then what do we do after? So thank you for thinking of the steps that we can actually take and be responsible and be held accountable. Luis, I know that you are from a small town, you mentioned earlier, right? West Cork?
Yeah, West Cork in Ireland, yeah.
Asking For It is inspired by the two cases, Steubenville and Maryville cases, and those happen in small towns. How did your town react to your book? Are they supportive? Were they shocked? Did they assume that you might have been talking about West Cork specifically?
No, you know, it's funny because I suppose physically I very much based Ballinatoom, the town in the book, on Clonakilty, which is my hometown, just because it was easier for me and I was being a bit lazy. As I said, this story, you know, rape culture is not specific to Clonakilty and West Cork. This is a global issue. This story could have happened in any small community in Ireland, and in any city in the United States, in Australia, in New Zealand, in Africa. I suppose because of that, everyone has been incredibly supportive, actually. And I think I'm very lucky in my hometown. There's a real sense of community here, and people really do care about each other. They've just been so proud of me, I think. And I feel like because obviously, you know, both of the books have done so well, there's a sense that my success is their success. And it's been really lovely, actually, to have that, I suppose, that kind of welcome from my community.
And how about your parents reading this? I'm sure it really shook them.
Yeah, it's funny because I said my dad was the first person to read it. He had really been sort of a Gaelic football star, and his family have been in this town since, 1900. I wanted him to read it, and there was a little bit of trepidation wondering about what his reaction would be like. He was just incredible. You know, he just said, I think this story is so important. He said, it's painfully honest. He said, and it's a frightening story, but he said, I'm so proud of you for writing it. I'm so proud of you for being brave enough put this down on paper. They have been nothing actually but supportive of me, and I think it makes my life so much easier because of the way in which I write and the manner of, I suppose, just the way in which I've taken the direction that I've taken in life. It makes it so much easier to have people around you that just say, don't censor yourself, be honest, be yourself, be authentic, who have never worried about how other people would react, or what the neighbors would say, or what would people think of us. That's never really been their priority. Their priority has been that I am happy and that I am healthy.
You mentioned that your dad is a Gaelic football
star? Yeah, that was what they were in the book. It's basically, how will I describe Gaelic football? It's a bit like soccer. except rougher. he trained the local football team, and he played for the local football team as well. So I suppose it was a world that I was very familiar with, and that sense of the local football star is being treated like gods. But he's not. I mean, my father is a real feminist and very much into equality. And, so, yeah.
I wonder if after reading your book that it maybe opened up your dad's eyes in different ways, where he might have shared stories with you where it's not him per se, but perhaps he heard of real life stories where men were even thinking about doing something like that to women. Did he share anything like that?
I'm not sure. I suppose the thing of my dad is that, he had two sisters and then he had two daughters. So I think he's kind of constantly been surrounded by women his entire life, So I don't know if he really would have bought into that sort of laddish culture, or if he would have, I just don't think it would have been his style, to be honest. And himself and my mother got married very young. They've been married since they were 21. I don't know if he ever really had the time. instead of having kids pretty quickly. So I don't know if he ever really had the time to sort of be a lad, or a bro, that kind of thing. But
something that I'm working on myself, uncovering a lot of like family stories and almost secrets. Sometimes I'm wondering, should I go forth with this? Should I not? How much do you censor? How much do you not?
And my answer to that would be that unless you're writing a memoir, or unless you know that you're writing a story in which you're giving details of real people with their real names, you cannot think like that. When you sit down at your desk to write your story, you have to write the story the way it is demanding to be told. Mm-hmm. And if you start thinking about what your parents think, or what your teachers think, or what your friends will think, or your ex-boyfriend will think, you're never going to be honest. And I suppose for me, honesty is the most important aspect of writing.
I would love to know how you think you have creatively evolved throughout your writings.
I think that depends on what type of writer you are. Because I know that when I finished Only Ever Yours, because it was a dystopian novel, a lot of people were wondering, is it going to be a trilogy? Are you going to write exclusively now dystopian fiction? And I really didn't want to do that. I wanted to challenge myself. I wanted to try and, write something different and something new. You have to push yourself. I do see an evolution, and you hope you're improving. I mean, that's, in anything that you do, you hope that the more that you do it, the better that you'll get at it. But I do think as well that I suppose you have your voice and you have your style, and that sort of shines through no matter what you write. So I think it's really important to, just to be very true to that as well.
Have you encountered writer's block? I know some authors don't believe in it. Some authors do very much understand what writer's block is. Do you?
To be honest, I didn't with the first two books, but I think I had both of them finished before Only Ever Yours came out. So there's a slight more pressure with this book, which does sort of engender a bit of writer's block. It's like what I said to you earlier. Once you start thinking about what other people think, whether those people, family, relatives, or the critics, or the audience, kind of paralyzes you. I think you have to. The thing about writing is that you just have to block out the outside world and just let it be you and the story. I think that's where I'm at the moment.
I like that. That's a great tip. Have you ever felt stuck in a moment, whether it's your career, writing, or just in life overall? And could you share that moment with us?
Yeah, I've definitely had those moments. I think everybody has. For me, they would have very much come with when I was struggling with anorexia and bulimia. But that's a lifelong struggle for me anyway, personally. I think that there are times where I have felt like I will never recover, or that I'm never going to get better, and that I'm a really determined person. Like, no matter, I think whenever that happens, I just keep going. And I think that's actually been very useful to me in my writing, because whenever I felt, oh God, I don't know what's coming next, I've just said, oh, I'll just write 1,000 words anyway. It'll be, even if it's nonsense, at least I'm kind of moving forward. It has been similar in life. I'm very tenacious. I think it's that, as I said earlier, that positive attitude that no matter how shitty things have been, and they have been shitty at times, that I've always had this really strong underlying feeling that things will improve. And I think I'm lucky in that way. I think I just have a real capacity for joy. I suppose that's very strong, that sort of guiding force in my life. So, I know that's probably not very useful advice to other people.
No, it is a very good reminder of how we should try to be when we are feeling stuck in moments. And to end off on a positive note, what are you excited about right now?
You know what I'm genuinely really excited about is that, you know, this book was published in September here in the UK, and it has been insane. It just took off in a way that I think I wasn't ready for and I wasn't anticipating. And I have just been in this sort of whirlwind since September of traveling and promotion and publicity and, you know, school visits and university visits and radio interviews, and just, it's been really mad. And from June on, it's just going to quieten down because I've sort of started saying no to everything. And I'm really, really excited about sleeping in my own bed every night, about getting back to my desk, about going for walks, you know, in the country, about getting back to my yoga, about getting back to my therapist on a weekly basis, just really actually putting the work into self-care,
yes,
just minding myself. And also, I need to write, you know, that's just when I need to write to feel okay. And I haven't really been able to have the time or the space to write. So I'm really looking forward to just getting back to my desk and my laptop.
I am really excited for you. And man, those long walks in the countryside sound really, really good. My goodness, I'm very jealous over here. Are there any books that you can recommend for us to check out?
Oh God, there's so many. I'm a real fan of Catherine Doyle, who's a YA author, and I also absolutely love Eliza Wass. She wrote this book. I think it's called The Cresswell Plot. That's the title of it in the US anyway, because it has a different one over here. And it's an amazing book. And I just finished Lindy West's collection of essays called Shrill. I'm actually interviewing her at the end of this month in Dublin. It's the sort of book that when you finish it, you realize that you've needed to read that book for your entire life. It is a step good, and I think incredibly important.
Can't wait to check that book out, and I'm excited for you to interview her. Congrats.
I'm going to try and make her the best friend, but we'll both.
Ease your way in there. That's awesome. I love it. I have hope.
Obviously, consent is very important.
Yes, of course. Oh my goodness, Louise, you've been amazing. Tell us where we can find you on social media to say hi.
I am all over social media. I'm probably most active on Twitter at Onillo. So that's O-N-E-I-L-L-L-O. And it's 3 L's because there's a very, very patient man called Orlando O'Neill in Seattle who is sort of bombarded tweets meant for me, and he's always very sweet about it. So.
It's like mail forwarding. He's just tweeting you, like, hey, so you got another one. Here it is.
So lovely, though. He's so lovely.
Thank you, Louise. You've been awesome.
No, thank you so much.
That wraps up our episode with the amazing Louise O'Neill. Louise, thank you so much for that honest and refreshing discussion. And listeners, thank you a million for listening in. I hope this episode stimulated you and pulled at your heartstrings the way it did with mine. I'd love to hear your thoughts about our chat today over on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. I've been loving all your messages and emails about the podcast and have been listening to what you're looking for. A lot of you have reached out asking about writing communities and classes, and I'm so excited to tell you more about Gotham Writers. If you're working on your own children's book, anything from a picture book to young adult novel, I really want you to listen to why Gotham is an incredible asset to writers. They started in my favorite city of all time, New York City, my home, where a lot of my dreams came true. Just like me, Gotham also believes that everyone has a story to tell, and they exist just so they can help writers like you tell your story better. You learn from teachers who are accomplished writers and are amazing at teaching. Through lectures, writing exercises, and workshopping, you learn how to enter the psyche of young people with a grown-up sense of craftsmanship. Gotham teaches writers all the elements of craft in a way that best resonates with young readers, and better yet, you'll learn how to entertain and enlighten young minds. On top of making progress on your work, Gotham will also introduce you to the ways of the business. They've put a lot of heart and soul into creating a safe and structured environment for writers to learn for over 20 years. Be sure to head over to 88cupsoftea.com/Gotham Writers to check out their classes. They have a super supportive staff that will help you find the course that's perfect for you. Hey guys, it's me again. Thanks so much for listening in on 88 Cups of Tea. Go create something magical today, and I'll catch you in the next episode. Bye.